You are listening to WDOT Port Washington. The program you are listening to may contain language or material that could be considered offensive. The views expressed are those of the DJ and not those necessarily those of WDOT or other WDOT station members. We therefore advise you to carefully consider whether you or your children should listen. Hi, everyone. I hope you had a rockin' new year. As always, this is your host, Gabriel, and for this episode of the Epic Entertainment Roundup, we have a very special guest, Drew Ekman. He is a retired editor for a major publication and is here to talk about his journey from working at Newsweek to transitioning into the music industry as a solo rock and roll frontman. Drew, Happy New Year. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to me.
Nice to talk to you, Gabriel. Glad to be on your show today.
Thanks. Could you tell me a little about yourself?
Well, since you mentioned Newsweek and the magazine world, it has a lot to do with both a couple aspects of my life. I was associate editor at Newsweek for 32 years. I worked in layout and design, and I retired a bunch of years ago. And I also, while I was doing that, I put on concerts at my house, something called Live at Drew's, which I brought national touring bands into play in my living room. So after I retired, I kept on doing the concerts, and there was a band called the Weaklings, who are kind of a Beatle-y New Jersey band here. They do a lot of their own stuff in the Beatles style, and they do a lot of Beatles songs as well. And I was out for a run before the show, and I just got a crazy idea that maybe they'd let me sing a song with them. For no reason. I wasn't a singer. But when I was a kid, my father used to bowl on Friday nights, and I used to go with him. And he would give me a couple bucks or whatever, or a dollar to, you know, make my way around the bowling alley while he bowled. And I would always play on the jukebox the Beatles song, You Can't Do That, from their second album. So I said, no, I wonder if they'd let me do You Can't Do That, kind of a tribute to my father. And so I asked them, and they talked it over, and they said that I could. So I sang the song, and, you know, it went over all right. And then after the show, there was a guy who lives in my town who I actually worked with at Newsweek for 15 years, and he was a lifelong musician. So he came up to me, and he said, hey, we have to do something. And I said, okay, about what? And he said, well, you'll sing, and I'll play guitar, and we can do something. I said, you're craziest. That was, you know, one time, and I'm not a singer. And no, we have to do it. I said, yeah, sure, maybe. So he kept calling me, or called me every now and then, and said, hey, let's do something. I said, I'm not up for that. I don't want to do it. And after a few times, he called me one day, and I said, nah, I'm really not interested. And he said, well, I'm coming over to your house right now with a guitar. I'm on my way. So I said, okay. So we sang some songs, and he played guitar. I don't play any instruments. And it went okay, I guess. And, you know, he was a musician for 50 years. And unfortunately, he died last week, this guy. So, but he was a musician for 50 years, and he had all these music connections. So one by one, he would get, you know, okay, I've got a... He was a bass player, but he played guitar as well. He said, you know, I've got this drummer who, you know, he'll play behind us. And I got this guy who's a harmonica player, and he'll play behind us. And eventually there got to be this little band. And, you know, I sang all the songs, and we did Elvis songs and some Beatles songs and Kinks and stuff like that. And eventually we got to play at a place in the city in New York called the Delancey, which is on very, very east Delancey Street. And so we did this show, and I had some friends come, and, you know, it was we thought it was okay. Hey, great job, all that. And then about 6 months later, I heard a recording of the show, and if I had heard it the next day, I would have stopped right there. It was terrible. It was really, really bad. And but we had now, by the time I heard it, it was probably 4 or 5 months in, and we had we had rehearsed a bunch of times. We had kind of whittled down to, you know, a kind of a select four guys, or four guys, I guess it was at the time, who were going to be part of the band. So then we started playing out in bars in New Jersey, and which I didn't like at all. And I told the guys, look, I don't want to play these places anymore. And they said, well, if we play, we only play covers, and we have to do, if we play here, we have to play covers. I said, well, we're not going to play there anymore. Yeah, but we play here and we have to play covers there. I said, well, we're not going to play there anymore. I said, well, but we don't have any of our own songs. I said, okay, I'll start writing songs. So I was going down to Florida to visit my mother, and I took a piece of paper with me. I folded it in four and put it in my back pocket and took a pencil. And I wrote a song on the way down, and I wrote a song on the way back. So now we had two songs. And so we kind of put them in. We did a couple other shows, and we put two songs in. And then I wrote a couple more songs, and we put it, And it got to where we got to be a band doing all our own songs.
What was the name of those first two songs that you made?
The first song was called, the band by now, my last name is Ekman. So we decided to call the band X-Men.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was ECK apostrophe S men. So it's a cool name, but the bad thing about it was if you told somebody the name, I had to explain it all the time. It's X, yeah, but it's ECK apostrophe S. It's not X. The first two songs I wrote were, I actually have to look because I don't remember the names. It was. First one was called You or Me, and the second one was called I Told You So.
Were
on our first album.
Where do you get your inspiration for your songs?
A couple different places. A lot of times it'll just be a phrase that I'll hear. Like one of the first songs I wrote was called Forgive and Forget. And I just kind of liked that leads off the first album. And I just kind of liked the sound of that, Forgive and Forget. So I said, okay, I can write something about Forgive and Forget. And so I tend to write the chorus first. And, once I have what I think is a cool chorus, then I kind of write the song around the chorus. Sometimes I'll hear a song, or rather a line in somebody else's song. And I'll say, oh, that kind of, wow, that reminds me of this. And then I'll say, huh, I wonder if I could get something out of that. Mm-hmm. And, my stuff, my current album that just came out in November, is called Don't Forget the Role. And that's because I think if you tell people you play rock music, that covers a really wide area. Rock music can be the Beatles, rock music can be Pink Floyd, rock music can be Frank Zappa. But if you tell people you play rock and roll and you don't forget the role, people pretty much know you're in the Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, 3-minute songs that are, going to make you shake your rear end, kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's, rock, there are a lot of phrases that you'll just hear in everyday life and say, I wonder how, maybe I could get something out of that. Just want to look at the titles. The first song I wrote for this album was called Friendly Fire. Mm-hmm. And there's a band that had a song that it mentioned, it was about Vietnam, actually. It was about the Vietnam War. And I just got an image of bombs going off and, flares up in the air and stuff like that. And then I went for, I took the term friendly fire and turned that into a kind of a rock and roll love song. Mm.
And you record your songs in a recording studio, right?
It's a studio, and it's after, again, like I told you, I don't play any instruments. Mm-hmm. Which makes things a little bit difficult. So what I do is I come up with all the words, and then I sing the songs to myself. And it might be, my mother lives in Pennsylvania, so I drive an hour and 45 minutes to Pennsylvania. So I might take a song, and I'll start singing it, and I'll sing it one way. Then I'll sing it another way. And I sing it, and I record it in my phone until I get the version that I like. So then I now have, me singing into the phone, and I have the melody of the song. And so the band then, I have them basically create the music that I have in, you know, that I sing on the recording. So after we, you know, we got pretty good at that. You know, basically the guys played exactly what I told them to play. And, you know, I would sing, you know, da 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 da. And they might play da 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 da. I said, no, 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 that's not it. You know, it's da 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 da. And then they would try again. And then when they got exactly what I wanted, we went on. So after the first band split up, the X-Men split up, I had a friend who lived in Maine. He's in a band called, his name is Chris Rogers, Chris with a K. And he's on Steven Van Zandt's Wicked Cool record label.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and Chris is a keyboard player, and he's really good. And he was the original, my original thought to produce my first album. We ended up going with Tommy Stinson, who was the bass player in The Replacements and Guns N' Roses. And he Tommy produced the first record. So I had Chris in mind for, you know, for anything I started doing again. And I called Chris and I said, hey, look, you know, I've got these songs, and do you think you'd be interested in producing them? And he said, yeah, I would. He said, but I said, I don't have a band anymore. So do you know a band up in, Chris lives in Maine. He said, could you, I said, could you find a band for me maybe? He said, well, yeah, I could do that, but you'd probably have to use my band. And I was like, whoa, you know, fabulous. You know, Chris Rogers and the Dirty Gems, they're, you know, they're on Steve's label. They're on the radio, you know, on Sirius all the time. So I went up and I recorded, I had written a song called I Told You Friendly Fire. So I went up there, and just about a year ago now, or 2 years ago now, and I recorded Friendly Fire with these guys. And they it's a home studio, more or less. But Chris is really good at what he does, and he gets a lot out of, like, when I first saw the studio, I was like, oh, my God, this is what I'm getting into. And it turned out to be great, though. So, yes, there is a studio, but it's a home. It's not in a separate building or anything like that. It's in a guy's house.
So is it true that Peter Buck from REM recorded a song with you guys?
Yeah, I kind of knew Peter a little bit. Peter played at my house a few years back with his band that's called the Baseball Project. He and Mike Mills, both from REM, were in that band. And a guy named Scott McCoy, who was kind of the fifth member of REM. He was he was always on stage with them, always played guitar with them, but was never quite, you know, officially in the band. So I had a song called Destiny. And I wanted Peter to, I thought it might be a good idea to get Peter to play on it, at least ask him to play on it. So I recorded Destiny up in Maine, and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to try to get Peter Buck to do the guitar on this. And about a week later, I was talking to Chris Rogers, and I mentioned that again, and he said, yeah, that's too bad, because Ryan, who is the guy who played guitar originally on the song, really liked the solo that he did on that song. So I said, okay, you know, I said, I'm not married to Peter playing that song. Maybe I'll find another one for him. So another guy who's in the Baseball Project, who is also in a band called the Dream Syndicate, his name is Steve Wynn. And I got in touch with Steve, and I said, hey, do you think Peter would play on one of my songs? And he said, well, can't hurt to ask him. So he gave me the contact for Peter. And he said he would do it. And so I sent the song. Peter lives, it's funny, because I recorded all the music in Portland, Maine. And Peter lives in Portland, Oregon. So we sent the song called Through Your Eyes out to him. And he said, yeah, cool song, I'd love to do it. I was like, oh, this is unreal, you know. I started doing this 3 years ago or 4 years ago, and now I have Peter Buck from REM playing on one of my songs. So so Peter did the solo on it. I'm sorry, he didn't do the solo on it. I just wanted him to play the solo. So he took the song and he played 12-string electric guitar under the whole song. And Scott McCoy, the fifth member of REM, he did the solo on it. So I have two REM guys on the song.
Oh, wow. What was it like working with them?
You can't really say. I mean, they were completely polite and nice and great, but, you know, they were 3,000 miles away. So everything was done remotely. And again, since I don't play anything, they did everything with Chris Rogers. But, you know, I asked them to do it. They got back to me promptly, said they would do it, sent them the song. Peter, you know, went above and beyond by not only doing the solo, but doing, you know, playing through the whole song, complimenting the song, complimenting me. Scott doing the work as well. He kind of worked as the intermediary between he and Peter. Both live in Portland, so it was fabulous. They were very easy to work with and very great to work with.
So going back to those shows at your house, do you have do you have any like favorite show that comes into memory?
I do, which, you know, I don't think this one was the best show ever, or I, you know, it's not the most memorable show ever for the people who came to it, but probably my favorite show I've been doing this since 1997. I've put on over 340 shows here.
Wow.
And it's guys, you know, people who were in The Who, The Animals, you know, Mitch Ryan and the Detroit Wheels played here once, The Zombies played here.
Wow.
You know, a lot of big bands. But my favorite show is probably, I don't know if you're familiar with John Wesley Harding.
I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, he goes by Wesley Stace now, which is his real name. And he played a show, it was November 30th, 2003. So you can tell it's my favorite because I remember the date. He played a great show, came back and did a pretty long encore, and then said, is anybody doing anything? Anybody have anywhere to go? And I said, no, not really. And he said, well, I love this. This is great. I'm going to let's do it again. And so he played a third set. So it was three sets anyway. Really long show. He's funny as could be. And it was just great overall. And I think that's my, you know, in my top 10 shows of all time at my house, there are probably 20 shows or 25 shows that are in the top 10. You know, it changes on the day. But I think usually I count that one as my favorite.
Who drew in, like, the largest audience at your house?
The largest audience ever was a show. It was an unusually warm February night. And it was Jesse Malin. And I don't remember why it was so crowded, but I had about 180 people here. So which was like half the crowd was outside on the deck. And fortunately, it was a warm February night. I've had shows here when it was, you know, 5 degrees out or 6 degrees out. In fact, I was just watching a video of Simon Townsend from The Who. I think it was 6 degrees the night he played. And if that had been the Jesse night, it would have been trouble.
Yeah. So, do you have any funny stories from like a concert that you could talk
about? Jokes?
Yeah.
You want me to tell a joke?
No, just like a funny story that happened.
That happened at my house. Yeah. Let me see. Funny story. That's a good question, and I'm going to have to think about that. Next question. Give me another one. I'll think about a funny story that might happen.
So my parents grew up in Queens, New York, and my dad grew up listening to all types of music, including hardcore rock and bands like D-Generation. Could you tell me a little about your relationship with the New York rock and roll legend Jesse Malin, who used to front D-Generation?
Sure. When that was happening, I kind of missed it. I'm not sure what I was listening to, but a lot of the bands who are my favorite bands now and who I really like and have liked for the last 20 years, I missed it when they were playing at CBGB's and when they were playing at Max's Kansas City and all those kind of cool little clubs. And I honestly don't know what I was listening to then, but I did miss that. I met Jesse first at a show in the East Village at a place called Pianos, I think, little place on Ludlow Street. And I met him at a bar called Black and White. Mm-hmm. And it was funny, I used to go to Black and White on Tuesday nights. They had a really cool trivia night. And my girlfriend and I used to go there and play trivia. Sometimes we hosted the trivia game there too. So one night I went in there on a Tuesday, and there was nobody in there. And it was only like an hour before the trivia was supposed to begin. So I asked the bartender, what's going on? How come nobody's here? He said, well, there's actually a private party tonight. And, we're not doing trivia. He said, but you're a regular, so you can hang out for a little while before you have to go. So it turned out it was a birthday party for this guy named Giorgio Grimalski, mm-hmm. who he was the Rolling Stones manager, I think, for a little while. And he used to hold these parties in the city called Green Door Parties. And all these punk bands used to go basically to his loft and play on Saturday nights. And they would charge, $5 to get in or whatever. And it was like a pretty big scene in the village. Mm-hmm. Actually, it wasn't in the village. It was in the 20s, I think. So these people are walking in. And I'm not paying much attention. And then my girlfriend showed up, which actually, unbelievably, I think she may have gone to a album signing with your father.
Oh.
I think that Patty Scalfa, if I'm not mistaken, that might be the case. It is the case. So she came in and she says, how come nobody's here? So they're doing a party tonight. And then she said, isn't that Jesse Malin down at the end of the bar? So I can't see really far, I'm nearsighted. So I looked down at the end of the bar and I said, I don't know, it might be, I'm not sure. Now we had just seen Jesse for the first time at a Bruce Springsteen show down in Asbury Park. They used to do a big Christmas show every year, or for a few years they did it anyway. And Bruce kind of introduced Jesse. So she said, well, I have a video of that show. I'm going to go, see if he'd like a copy of it. So she went back to her apartment, which was like two blocks away. And I walked down and started talking. I said, hey, I saw you the other night. And he was really nice. And I said, hey, I do these shows at my house. Would you be interested? And he's like, we'll see. Because it's at the time, I hadn't had that many shows here. And, you're asking somebody to play at your house. It's kind of, out in the sticks of New Jersey. And it was a little weird, I guess, he thought. So we talked for a few minutes, and then Steve Van Zandt came in shortly after that.
Oh, wow.
And I asked him to play here. He's no, I don't play anywhere anymore. So I said, come on, man, you can play it. Acoustic. No. I said, acoustic with horns. No. So we left, and I would see Jesse around the village every now and then at shows. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of reminded him, hey, keep in mind, you can do my house. And so then finally he did come out and played. And so as of today, Jesse, he's played here. He's the person who's played here the most. He's played here 22 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he's played indoors solo. He's played as a duo, as a trio. He's played with a 7-piece band with horns. He's played indoors. He's played outdoors. He's done, a show on Saturday and Sunday and the weekend. So Jesse's a good friend. And, we've been friends now for just about 20 years.
How does it feel that you know all of these people and they've actually been inside of your house before?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. There's an old joke. The president, Alex Rodriguez and I don't know who's, and Tom Brady, what do they have in common? None of them have ever been in my kitchen, And with me, with a lot of musicians, it's the opposite. They have been in my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
When I did my 100th show, I sent a letter, actually via Jesse Malin, to Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, wow.
And that's what I said. I said, what do so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so have in common, who are all people who had played with Bruce? And I said, you know, the standard joke would have been none of them have been in my kitchen. I said, but the answer to this question is, you know, they've all been in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of it's interesting because, you know, you I've met almost 99% of the people have been, if not more, have been very nice. They're a great bunch of people, you know, doing what they do. And it's kind of it's fun to go somewhere and somebody will, you know, I'll be with somebody and we'll run into, like I was in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest Festival one year and I was watching the show and I turned around and coincidentally Peter Buck was standing, you know, three people behind me. So I turned around and he said, hey, Drew, how are you? It's like, this is weird. You know, like people, you know, you go to Madison Square Garden to see this guy, and then you turn around at this place, and he's saying hello to you. And a few years later, I was invited to the wedding of Alejandro Escovedo down in Austin.
Oh, wow.
And Peter Buck was also there. And he and I were at the bar trying to get drinks and couldn't because it was kind of packed. And I said, mm-hmm. Look, let's order four drinks instead of two. And he said, why? I said, because then we won't have to come back. You know, we'll have two each. Great idea, you know? So, but you find out that, you know, the people you see on stage, once you're on stage, it's a different person, you know? It's, you know, everyone is focused on that one person. And, you know, if you're in a group, in a club with, you know, 50 or 100 people, or you're in a theater with 2,000 people, or you're in Madison Square Garden with 20,000 people, you know, everyone is focused on those three or four people on stage. Where when you meet them outside of, you know, of a show, it's one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're giving back to you and you're giving to them. And it's nice to be able to have conversations with people and to be recognized with people like that.
Did Bruce ever write you back? Fun. You were talking about how you sent him a letter. Did he ever write you back?
No, he didn't. But that day, it was Sting's birthday party show. And I don't know what birthday it was, but, and it was kind of funny because a lot of people came here thinking that Bruce Springsteen was going to play. Mm. And, let me tell you this. It was normally $20 to get into a show here, you know, to see, and the bands take all the money. I don't make any money from it. It's just a hobby for me. Mm. So that show, since it was my 100th show, I said, you know what, I'm going to charge $100 to get in and I'm not going to tell anybody who's playing.
Oh,
so it was a secret who was playing. So all these people said, oh, it's got to be Bruce Springsteen. It's got to be Bruce Springsteen. Drew likes Bruce. You know, blah, blah, blah. So the opening act came on, and it was Robert Gordon who did the song Springsteen Stone Fire. So now people are like, oh, he's got to be here. He's got to be here. And, you know, I never said a word. And, you know, people were here. The opening act came on. Nobody knew who was going to be playing, and it turned out to be Robert Gordon. And then nobody knew who the main act was going to be. Mm-hmm. And so people were anticipating that and were let down when it wasn't, I guess. But it was Mitch Ryder and Detroit Wheels played here. And so that was a fun show to do. But he didn't get back to me personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you've been a longtime fan and attended numerous Bruce Springsteen concerts. How has Bruce actually shaped your interest in music?
In music, it depends what stage. You know, I love the early stuff. The River is my favorite album.
Yeah, very good.
And probably because the songs are, for the most part, are 3 minutes, and they're 3-minute rock and roll songs, which is, you know, that's my style. That's what I like. So I probably took something from that. My second favorite album is Tunnel of Love, which is actually nothing like The River, but I do like the songs on there. I guess, you know, you can write interesting songs. I think some of my songs are interesting to listen to, as well as being, you know, shake your ass kind of songs. Most of the songs are, most of my songs are kind of sad songs, but they're sad songs that you want to dance to. You know, they're kind of, they're fun at the same time. Before you were asking about influences on the songs, how do I get the songs? You know, people, you know, and you've dealt with, can be a really big inspiration for songs. You know, old girlfriends, play a big part, a real big, one especially plays a real big part, in the songs that I've written. And you know, not so much musically, because you know Springsteen was always a pretty major force in what I liked. But as far as you know, you hear people say, "Oh, do this," you know, it's a life changing event, or you know, this. Oh, you know, I heard this, or I did this, I ate this, whatever it is, and you know, it changed my life. Mm-hmm. The first time I ever saw Bruce Springsteen, I was 19, and I went. There was a club in New York called The Bottom Line, which held 400 people. And Springsteen was playing there for 5 nights, 2 shows a night, 5 nights. It was a Wednesday through a Sunday. And I knew about him. I had never heard him. But I was listening to the radio one night with a friend of mine. We were driving somewhere. And they said, "Oh, that was Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band." And I said, "Oh, you know, I said, that guy's supposed to be really good. We should go see him sometime," because we went to concerts all the time. Mm-hmm. So I saw that he's playing at The Bottom Line. And I said, "You know what? I'm going to go see him." I worked until about 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And so I drove into New York by myself. I got a ticket outside and went into to The Bottom Line. And I was one of the first people in. And all the other people were in there. They seemed to all know each other. And it was like, "Hey, Tommy, how many shows are you coming to?" "No, I'm coming to all 10. I'm like, "What? This guy's coming to all 10? How about you?" "I can't make the late show on Saturday, but I'm coming to the other 9. And how about this guy?" And somebody said, "Hey, how many shows are you coming to?" I said, I've never even heard him before. So they said, "Get this, Tommy. You know, this guy's never heard Bruce. Wow." And he said, brother, "You're in for the time of your life." And so the lights go down and Bruce comes out by himself and he starts playing on the piano the song "For You." And I'm listening to the song and I was like, "Oh, this is unreal. This is so good." So the song's over and I said, "I've never heard of this guy before. I've never heard this guy before. That might be the greatest song I've ever heard." And then it went from there. So I ended up going, I saw him 5 times in 5 nights.
Yeah, Bruce is a special performer. The first concert I went to, I went with my dad. He took me, and I had a great time. But Bruce actually gave me his harmonica. He threw it to me from the stage.
Fabulous. That's cool. The last time I saw Bruce was in last March, I guess. And my girlfriend got the harmonica.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you have something in common. That's funny. I saw him the Wednesday late show at The Bottom Line. Then I went back on Thursday to the late show and I took a friend of mine. And then Friday I went back to the late show and took my girlfriend. Saturday we were online. I had tickets to another show and we were waiting online at The Bottom Line to see Bruce again. And my girlfriend and my friend were saying, "Come on, let's go to the other show. We have tickets." And I said, "I want to go to this." "Oh, come on, we have tickets." So we ended up going up to Central Park to see another show. And then Sunday we came back and went to the early show. I drove my girlfriend back to New Jersey and turned around and went back to New York and got into the late show. So I saw both shows on Sunday.
Oh, nice. When you're currently in the car or in your home, who's currently on your playlist?
I've always listened to Bob Dylan. I listen to Bob Dylan a lot. I listen to The Replacements a lot. There's a band I like called the Midnight Callers, who are from they're from this area, from the New York, New Jersey area. I like them a lot. There's a band from LA led by, actually, it's three girls and a guy. The guy's a drummer. It's funny because his name is Drew. And they are called The Regrets. I don't know if you know them or not.
I haven't heard of them before.
Yeah, check them out. They're really good. The girl now, her name is Lydia Knight. She's the lead singer and the songwriter. And she's probably 21 now, but she's been like a kind of a rock star since she was 17 or 18. And she writes really fun songs. And 2 years in a row, my number one song on Spotify was their version of a song from Hamilton, from the play Hamilton.
Love
they
that.
They did a rock version of Helpless is the name of the song.
Yes.
Yeah, and check out The Regrets, R-E-G-R-E-T-T-E-S. And their version of Helpless is great, really, really good. Rockin' song. So I like them. And in fact, I went to see them. The first time I ever heard them on the radio, I liked them, and I looked them up to see if they were where they would be playing. And they had played in New York the night before, so I missed them. So I kind of forgot about them for a while. And then about 6 months later, I said, let me see if that band is playing again. So I looked them up, and they had played in New York the night before. So I missed them twice. Aww. So again, a year later, probably 2 years later, I looked them up again, and they were going to be touring. So the closest they were getting to the New York City area was Albany. Mm-hmm. So I live about 2 hours south of Albany. Mm-hmm. So that's not too bad. I'll get tickets and I'll go to Albany. It's a Thursday night. You know, it'll be something to do. Mm-hmm. So I have a cousin who lives up there. I called him up. Do you want to go to the show? We went, or we were going to go. And I said, look, I said, it's Thursday night. Nobody knows who this band is. We're in Albany. We might be the only people in here. And we got to the club, and the line was like around the block, people waiting to get in. And we squeezed in there. It was so packed. And the crowd was, you know, jumping up and down to every song and knew the words to every song. And interestingly, this was probably summer of 2019, I would think. And she was wearing a mask, a surgical mask. Mm. Way before anybody even thought of wearing them, you know, but she had one on when she came on stage, and when she went off stage, she was wearing a mask. So I don't know if she was a germaphobe or what the story was, but in light of what's happened since then, it was interesting. Mm-hmm.
So lastly, do you have any advice for someone in high school that would want to be an editor or a musician today?
An editor is difficult, I think, because I left the print media world at exactly the right time. It was just beginning to spiral downward. I got Newsweek they were asking people if they wanted to leave. Hey, look, we'll give you a really good deal if you leave, if you're willing to leave now. And so I looked at the numbers of everything that I could do, and it seemed like I could make it work. So I got out, and I got a pretty good deal for getting out. As far as being a musician or doing in general, if you have something you want to do, get out there and do it. It's a lot better to do something than to think about doing it. You know, I became a musician, and I still don't consider myself a musician, but other people do. I never, ever even thought about it before that I sang that song, You Can't Do That. Mm-hmm. I never thought about, I want to sing, I want to write songs. And that's why my first album is called Who Knew? Because who knew?
Yeah.
I certainly didn't, but what happened was when I did get the bug to do it, and got to doing it, I gave it my all. I wanted to do, my songs and songs that I liked. And the other guys that were in my band, they were all in the cover band world. They've been doing it for 50 years. They were playing the same songs every Saturday night in the same crappy bars. And that was what they wanted to do. They wanted to make the money. they were into it for, you know, for the $100 or whatever you get a night to play. Where I wanted to do it because I wanted people to hear what I had to say. I wanted people to dance. I wanted people to hear my music, you know, what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. Not what, you know, I didn't want to sing Beatles songs and Jackson Brown, Take It Easy, or the Eagles, Take It Easy, you know, every single night. I wanted to create something. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, part of the reason that the original band broke up. They wanted to do one thing and I wanted to do another. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I now have another record out. I have Peter Buck from REM playing on it and Scott McCoy from REM playing on it. On the radio, fairly often. In fact, there's a station down in Florida that's going to be playing. I just saw they're going to be playing one of my songs today. And these guys are still playing in the bars, local bars, you know? And I get out there. I have a friend who's in a band called The Sins, C-Y-N-Z. Mm-hmm. And she's a lead singer in this band, and they're really good. They're a rock band based out of Hoboken, basically. And the lead singer said to me a couple weeks ago, she said, "You know, I'm on a record label, and you're on the radio more than I am." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, I work my ass off. I really do. So, you know, I got this opportunity to do this, and I'm not going to let it go. I'm going to push at it and keep doing it." And that, you know, that's the same for any, you know, anything you choose to do. Get out there and do it, no matter, you know, no matter how small a part you may have in something. You know, one thing leads to another. You know, look at Jimmy Iovine, who is like, you know, did the, what he owns Pods and all. He produced he engineered Springsteen albums and everybody's album. And now he's like a major, major player in the music industry, if not the major player. He's one of the top three or four people, probably. And he started by just like going in and helping out. Mm-hmm. And it turned out he was really good at helping out. So they had him do other stuff, you know, and he became really good at that. And he worked his way to the top. And it's a lot of hard work, but you have to do it. And you can't let other people kind of hold you back either. You know, I used to coach athletes, runners, and I used to always tell them, look, don't run with your friend, okay, in practice, because what always happens almost 100% of the time is the slower guy says, "Hey, look, come on, you come back with me, you run with me." They don't make the effort to run with the faster guy and get better. They'd rather just kind of stay where they are and you know, be content and happy with that. But the people who make the move, say, "You know what? I'm going to try to stay with the fast guy today." And maybe you can't the first day. So you try again. And after a while, you're going to be staying with him. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you get some extra motivation from that and say, "You know what? I'm going to try to beat him today. And I'll try to stay a little bit ahead of him." And, you know, that's how you get ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to thank you again for taking the time out today and sharing with me and my listeners a little about your careers.
Yeah, my pleasure. I hope you I enjoyed talking to you. I hope you enjoyed talking to me.
Thank you. And until next time, this is Gabriel with the Epic Entertainment Roundup saying have a good day.